All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to be looking in Isaiah 14 through chapter 17, and so you can turn there. Keep in mind that the chapter divisions help in the prophetic works, but you shouldn't be, you know, a slave to them. And so that's why sometimes we break these up. It makes more sense. So that's where we're going to start this morning. Glad to see everyone. Ray Conies, can you lead us in a prayer as we begin our study?
Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, thank you that we're able to be here today. Thank you, Father, that we can turn our minds specifically through our teacher in front of us. We ask you to bless him as he teaches. We turn our minds towards you and specifically your servant, Isaiah, and help us to be a fruitful time. Help our faith to grow more as we learn more through these studies. And bless our worship here. And our service to you, and not only us, but others meeting here in other classes. And in the same way, Father, that you're glorified and we're edified. And we ask all this in your Son's name, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. So, have you ever heard orienteering? Okay. What is it? And if you don't know, you might can figure it out by the images. What's orienteering? I mean, I would think it's a big deal around here, is it? Go ahead, Justin. It is a competition. Yeah. Okay, that's a great definition. Drop them in the middle of nowhere and see if you can find your way back. Now, I like the way he put that, because are some of you feeling like in reading the prophets, you've been dropped in the middle of nowhere and you're trying to find your way through it, okay? That can happen in the prophets. They're vast. They really are. You really have to be on your toes when you're studying the prophets. And so orienteering is where you use maps and compasses to find your way to a certain location in the middle of nowhere. And I would imagine that's a thing around here. I mean, this is a great place for that, and with the trails and so forth. And so it's important as you study the prophets that you stop occasionally and look at the compass and look at the map. You need to orientate yourself in space because the prophetic books sometimes are focused on certain places or they're written at certain places for certain people in certain places. But more importantly, orienteering regarding time. Where are we in the flow of things? Historically, where are we? So one more time, we're going to keep doing this through the year, sort of look at some devices, uses some devices that help us to orientate ourselves in studying the prophets. Understand the prophets, and this is why I suggested to go back and look at that video that Ken and I made a couple years ago, and I sent, if you want a link to it, I can send it to you, but it's in the collection of videos on the YouTube, and it's about the survey of the Old Testament history. And there was one video we did about the empires of the Old Testament. There are three late empires. There are other empires that are referenced in the Old Testament. But to understand the prophets, you need to be aware of the three late empires. First being the Assyrian Empire, who God used the Assyrians to punish and really to destroy, to conquer Israel, the northern kingdom, and then used Assyria to judge and punish Judah, though Judah was not completely conquered. A lot of the fortified cities were taken, but Jerusalem was not. And we'll see even in our study of the book of Isaiah later, a very dramatic period where the Assyrians are about to take Jerusalem and they're turned back, and Jerusalem is spared there. So Assyria is this first mighty empire that is dominating things. And so several of the books that we call the prophetic books are written with the threat of Assyria, including Isaiah. And then there are parts of Isaiah that come after the Assyrian threat. They're still in existence, but they're not as threatening as they were. And then the next mighty empire is Babylon. And God uses Babylon after Israel has been conquered and, you know, absorbed into the Assyrian Empire to threaten Judah and to actually invade Judah. And in a series of events, they take control of Judah, even controlling who's king. And finally, because of Judah's rebellion, they just wipe out Judah. And they level the city of Jerusalem, take most people captive, but not everyone. We studied this Wednesday night. Who did they not take captive? What prophet?
Judah.
What prophet?
Jeremiah.
Thank you, Jennifer. Jeremiah. Jeremiah was not taken. He's still left there in Judah. So, and then there is this third mighty empire that comes into play in the latter historical period here of the Old Testament and is important regarding several prophetic works. The last prophetic works, particularly Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, are happening in light of the Persian rule and part of Daniel. Daniel is a court official for first the Babylonians and then the Medo-Persian Empire. So the Persians are used not to punish. God uses them to bring back a remnant to Judah, to repopulate Judah and rebuild Jerusalem. And that's what some of the latter prophetic works are about, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. So those three empires. So the more you can learn about them this year, the better you'll be. And so do your own, you know, probing around. There are videos about them and books you can find about them because they're talked about, especially Assyria and Persia, so many world history works. Each of the prophetic writings, everything from Isaiah to Malachi, can be placed in one of these periods or phases. It's when the Assyrians are threatening, or it's when the Babylonians are threatening, or it's after the Babylonians and the Persians are ruling, and the Jewish people, that's what they're called now, at the end of the Old Testament, because most of them that were left were of the tribe of Judah, they're interacting with the Persians. And actually the Persians are used by God to help them, you know, help facilitate their return back. And I want you to look at this. This is actually in our text this morning. Look at Isaiah 14 in verse 26. Vince, can you read that for us? Isaiah 14, verse 26.
This is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations.
All right, thank you very much. That is a really great theme verse for today's lesson, and in part what we looked at last week. God is ruling over all the nations. His hand is stretched out over all the nations. Isaiah, though other books do it too, Isaiah, more than any of the prophetic books, it has a very broad international scope. It has tons of material about Israel, tons of material about Judah, but it has a very international scope as well. And says a lot about Assyria, Babylon, and Persia, all three of them, as well as some other nations, as we'll see today. So, just want to do a little orienteering there where we're at. And Isaiah is located. Isaiah is a unique prophetic work in that, and remember we talked about it's so mammoth and it's so broad in scope. Isaiah is prophesying roughly around over a 60-year period. And he's prophesying as Assyria is threatened, as the Assyrian threat diminishes and the Babylonian threat is on the horizon. So you could put him as a bridge here between these two periods, though it's going to be many, 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 many years later before the Babylonians will overcome Jerusalem. Isaiah will be dead by that point. But his prophecy is really very much in that one and two phase. Okay, any questions, comments on that? Okay, with map and compass in hand, let us go forward. Isaiah 14. Look here at Isaiah 14, verses 24 to 27. Joe, can you read those verses, please? Isaiah 14, 24 to 27.
The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass. And as I have purposed, so shall it stand, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. This is the purpose that is proposed upon the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out upon all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has proposed, and who shall disannul it? And his hand is stretched out, and who shall turn it back?
All right, thank you very much. Well, what questions? When the Lord stretches out his hand, who and what can stop it? Nobody. I suppose if we get one single thing from the prophets, it should be the absolute rule of God. I think that's a more important lesson than God's people better repent. God's people need to make changes. God has hope for His people. All those are incredible prophetic themes. And that's what we're seeing, right? Condemnation of sin, judgment's coming. God's going to restore and bless those who will be His remnant. All those are great prophetic themes found throughout all these writings. But if there is one thing we take away, you know, like people talk about, if you're stranded on a desert island, what's the one book you'd want? I hope all of us know what that answer is. But you know, you'll hear little, you know, questions posed like that, you know. If you could have only one car for the rest of your life, what would you have? Those kinds of questions. If there is one thing we take away from the prophets, it should be the absolute rule of God. And it's found on every page of the prophetic writings, and you really see it here in what we're going to look at here. So, this text that Joe just read is talking about a judgment on whom? Assyria. So, we're in this section of Isaiah, and there are some other prophetic works that do this a little bit too. Micah does it, but Isaiah does it to a great extent, and that is Isaiah is talking not just about God judging Israel and Judah, but also other nations. And recently, we've been studying about how he's going to judge Babylon. Now, what's interesting about this is that Isaiah, as we noted just a moment ago, is living at a time when Assyria is the threat. Babylon is down the road. He's going to write about the threat of Babylon, but Babylon as a real threat is in the future. Assyria is the threat. But we've just been reading about how that Babylon is going to be lifted up, but then God's going to do what to Babylon? Back in chapter 13 and earlier 14, He's going to judge Babylon. So now He's back to Assyria. So, okay, He's talking about Babylon first, but they're later, and now He's talking about Assyria second, but they're earlier. So this is where you got to really hang on to this. He's jumping around like these prophetic works do. What will happen to Assyria is that they will mow through Israel, and then in another campaign, they will mow through a big part of Judah, and they will be threatening. They will lay siege to Jerusalem. What does that mean, lay siege? It's a good time to ask that question because it's going to pop up this year. What does it mean to lay siege? Joe?
To surrender, surround a town. You cut out the water, the food, the shipments, and you restrict who goes in and who goes out.
Exactly. Becomes a waiting game, doesn't it? So you, like Joe said, you shrink down their resources and then you wait them out. And of course, these cities were usually constructed how? They were walled cities. So, and sometimes if the city was well supplied, it could wait it out. But in many cases, they couldn't. And so starvation set in. Sometimes they would capitulate, and sometimes they would find a breach in the wall. And so it became a really interesting kind of game. That's where you have these things like the catapult and other kind of weird devices you see. We saw an image of that in Assyria Wednesday night recently where they're trying to, you know, breach the walls, you know, and break a hole in it or get up on top of it or something. And so Assyria will lay siege to Jerusalem. But because of Hezekiah's faith in the Lord, with the guidance of Isaiah, God strikes the Assyrian army, and 185,000 Assyrian soldiers are struck dead in the middle of the night. And when what's left of the Assyrian leadership wake up, there's nothing to fight with, and they have to skedaddle home. And that will be a slow demise of Assyria. They will not be as strong in the coming years and decades. They get weaker, and then Babylon will finally supplant them. And so Assyria is going to be turned back, and we'll read about this narrative of that siege of Jerusalem and their defeat is going to be spelled out for us in the middle part of the book of Isaiah. So, and this is predicting that. Assyria, who's been mowing through so many nations in this region, they're going to be judged and they're going to be turned back and they're going to be defeated. And think about this. The people reading and hearing Isaiah, hearing him preach and reading what he's writing, many of them are going to be living when Assyria threatens Jerusalem, and they'll be living after the great defeat of Assyria. So then when Isaiah writes about God's judgment on Babylon and God's judgment on Judah, they better take heed, right? Tommy talked about this back in January. What's the first biblical criteria of believing in a prophet back in Deuteronomy? If what that prophet says, what? Comes true, comes about. So Isaiah in his lifetime is making predictions that are happening, like the turning back of the Assyrians. Assyria didn't look like anybody could turn them back. But they are turned back and they don't take Jerusalem. And so that verifies Isaiah as a legitimate prophet. So then he's going to write about these other nations. And they would be wise to take heed what he has to say. And it's interesting, Isaiah is going to write about all these different nations. And you're like, well, did he send them a copy? Oh, Philistia. Just wanted you to know I wrote this about you. I want you to read it. I don't think so. These are for the people of Judah to read and to listen to. These are, you know, Israelite prophets, but they're there in the record. And Israelite writings, Hebrew writings, become very widely read by the in the next several centuries under especially the Greeks. They make a translation of it called the Septuagint. And so other nations are going to learn about what Isaiah said about them. But it's interesting how that this is primarily for the people of Judah. And so let's look at what he's going to say about some of these people. Okay, so let's go now. Look at chapter 14. Joe, while you're right there, you're reading that other. Go ahead and read the next verse, verse 28 for us, please.
In the year that King Ahaz died was this burden.
Okay. In the year of King Ahaz, and he died. Remember, we started off in our introduction of Isaiah. There are several kings, about four kings, that their reign spans his lifetime or his years as a prophet. And Ahaz dies. Ahaz is that king who's ruling. Remember back in Isaiah 7, 8, 9? Ahaz is ruling when Israel and Syria, or Aram, threatens Judah. And Isaiah is saying to Ahaz, don't worry, God's going to protect you. God's going to overthrow those. But Ahaz was a very wicked man. He was an idolater. He's dead now. And the man who takes his place is Hezekiah. What kind of king was Hezekiah? You might know. Great king, reformer, purged the land of idolatry, righteous king, great leader. So this is now transitioning into the Hezekiah reign when Isaiah is alive. So think about this. It's in Hezekiah's reign, as we mentioned a while ago, that Assyria comes with a massive army to overthrow Jerusalem. And they are miraculously turned back. If you are a nation, and for Judah, you're a little nation at this point. When you are facing a big invader, what are you tempted to do regarding your neighboring nations? That's right, building alliances. Because the best shot for a little nation to withstand a big nation is to have partners, alliances. An alliance with a big nation would be nice, but a bunch of small nations wouldn't be helpful. And so think about this. Judah in these years of Assyrian and then eventually Babylonian threat, because these are very, for its time, these are very sophisticated military forces. They were swift. They were fierce. They had the most advanced weaponry, the most advanced techniques. They looked very formidable. So the temptation for Judah is to rely on these neighboring nations. Of course, all these neighboring nations were idolatrous and pagan. What does God want Judah to do? Rely on Him and seek Him. And so it's helpful for them to get a taste of, oh, you know these neighbors of yours? God is saying through Isaiah, this is what I'm going to do to them. So, let's look at this here. Let's read first of all about Philistia. Les, can you read chapter 14, 19, I'm sorry, 19, 29 to 32. Isaiah 14, 29 to 32.
Do not rejoice, all you of Philistia.
because the rod that struck you is broken. For out of the serpent's roots will come forth a viper, and its offspring will be fiery, a fiery flying serpent. The firstborn of the poor will feed, and the needy will lie down in safety. I will kill your roots with famine, and it will slay your remnant. Wail, O gate, cry, O city. All you of Philistia are dissolved, for smoke will come from the north, and no one will be alone in his appointed times. What will they answer the messengers of the nations, that the Lord has founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall take refuge in it?
All right, thank you.
So here's Philistia right here. They were a coastal people right here. And they were really tied together by a shared culture and racial heritage, but they were really a coalition of city-states. This is a very common thing in ancient times. A city-state, you'd have this city, walled, fortified city, and because of their power, and of course, like any city, they're a center of commerce, so there's wealth that builds up in them, and all the big powerful people live and associate with the city. The big men are there. And so they would exercise influence in the countryside around it, sometimes going out great distances. So these are called city-states. They're like a state, they're like a nation, but it all is centered upon the power of the city. So Philistia was made up of city-states and did not have like one king among them. Sometimes these cities, like Ascalon, et cetera, Ekron, they would have a king over that city. But the Philistines, and they're depicted as a group all through ancient writings and in the Old Testament, it's interesting how that they are, well, they're sort of like the United States. So it's a coalition of states from that standpoint, okay? So, Philistia. Okay, what's the backstory? Did you read this and you're like, these guys again? Why would you have that, these guys again, response to Philistia?
They're everywhere.
They're everywhere in earlier Old Testament. All right, Rick Light, what? Elaborate. Where do we see the Philistines?
Saul, the judges, all through there.
Right.
All the time.
And of course, Goliath was a Philistine. Okay. So in the period of the judges, when the Israelites have come in and they've taken the land of Canaan, in those early years before they even have a kingship, Philistia, the Philistines were one of the neighboring nations that were a threat and a problem to them. And then under the reign of Saul and David, they are like some of the chief enemies of the Israelites. And they continue to be an occasional thorn in the flesh to Israel. You'll still see them mentioned, although Rick's right, in the years of the judges and Saul and David is where you have the most references to the Philistines. But they're still around. And they still, at times, they clash with the people of Judah. Now, look what is said here. What's the warning in verse 29?
Do not rejoice.
Okay. Don't rejoice. Excellent. That's the thing he's telling them to do. Don't rejoice. Why?
Syria is broken.
What?
Syria is broken.
Okay. What he says here, don't rejoice that the rod that struck you is broken. When Assyria came and threatened Judah, they invaded along the coastal plain. Remember our New Testament geography class a year ago? This area is mountainous, so it's hard to move large armies through it. So they invaded along the coastal plain and then penetrated into Judah. Babylon did the same thing when they invade later on in 586, around 586. And as a result, Assyria mowed right through Philistia too. Well, Assyria has been turned back, as we'll read later on, with the defeat of the 185,000 overnight. And it's easy for Philistia to say, yes, we're free. We've got the Assyrians off our back. But what does he say? The rod that struck you is broken, but what? He mixes metaphors here. Rod, that's like a stick. And then he says root, which is also wood, but then he switches to what analogy? Not sticks, but what? Snakes, the things we love so much. Okay, snakes. That was facetious, okay? I'm very biblical in my orientation. Snakes are bad. I mean, you get that from the Bible, right? And whenever snakes are referred to, it's not good. So snakes are used as a reference to something that's attacking and dangerous and so forth. And look at this language. This is an example. Isaiah is an incredible statesman and poet. He's a phenomenal poet. See, God is inspiring these documents. But God is picking certain men with certain insights and abilities and talents to write these things. It's like he picks this Jewish rabbi in the New Testament to record so much of the New Testament, one who had converted to Christ but understood from that standpoint the law, and that's Paul. And so Paul was unique in writing Romans and Galatians because of his training and background, and God uses that. Isaiah, be impressed with Isaiah as a writer. Look what God is doing with this man. And this language here, for from the, this is English Standard, from the serpent's root will come forth an adder. So one snake has been defeated and what? Another snake follows. And to just really intensify it, what kind of snake is this at the end of verse 29? It's petrifying to me. Okay, if a snake's on the ground, I got that. I got ways I can get away from it. But if one's flying, that's even more threatening. A flying snake. Now, somebody help me. Do we have the... Are there flying snakes? I know flying squirrels, but I don't know of a flying snake. Is it?
Well, there could have been.
Okay, there could have been. That's true.
Like, yeah. Flying serpents existed to some degree, although pterodactyls and that kind of thing.
Right.
So
okay.
In a different category.
Reptiles, that's true. Dinosaurs that flew were reptiles. Okay, there might be some kind of...
Dragons.
Ancient bases, the dragons, okay. What? There's some species of snakes fall out of trees and glide. Okay, there you go. This is petrifying to me. Okay. All right, so, but think about what's worse than a snake? A flying snake. See the point? And even though the Assyrians, we've emphasized how vicious the Assyrians were. The Assyrians were sadistic in how they treated their enemies. Babylon doesn't have that kind of sadistic reputation. But when Babylon wanted to bring the hammer down, it was a sledgehammer. When they invaded and they wanted to take somebody out, they could take them out as quickly and brutally as anybody. So, and that's who's going to come. Philistia's like, hey, we got Assyria off our back. But guess who's going to come through? It's going to be about a century. But, you know, that's nothing to God. So you got to get outside the constraints of time when you read the prophets. Year, 2 years, 10 years, 60 years, 3 centuries, none of that matters. It's coming, whether sooner or later. And so that's what's going to happen, is they're going to suffer that way. And then look at verse 31. How does he depict what's coming in verse 31? And they should be wailing and crying, weeping because of this. Why? What does it say at the end of verse 31 about this invading force?
No one's left behind.
Okay. There's not a straggler among them. This is not a bunch of wimps and cowardly invaders. No stragglers. That's the last thing you need in a moving army is stragglers. No stragglers. And they're like smoke that comes from the north. Where there's smoke, there's... So it's the idea of a fierce, destructive force coming at them. And so that's what's going to happen. And this is, Zachary's right, these are references in this text to the passing threat of Assyria and the coming threat of Babylon. And look at this statement there in verse 32. It's talking about Philistia. What does Isaiah say about Zion? And Zion's another name for Jerusalem. What does he say about Zion? Lord's founded her, and in Zion can be refuge for his people. So in spite of the judgment statements that Isaiah is going to level at Judah, and even his predictions that they're going to be overthrown, not by the Assyrians, but somebody else, and it's going to be Babylon. God is still peppering these judgment statements with statements about God, God establishing Zion, God's people being in Zion, and God's people being protected by Him. And so it becomes a challenge to reconcile that with what's going to happen to Judah and what's going to happen to Jerusalem. But the best way to reconcile it is to understand, as we're learning in the prophets, that every time God talks about His people or Zion, He's not necessarily talking about physical Israel. Because what God is, one of the consistent, somewhat underlying, but it's not hidden at all, it's there, but a consistent theme in the prophets is through all this judgment, judgment against Israel, judgment against Judah, judgment against the nations, God's looking for His people. There's a purging, and He's looking for His people. And ultimately, that's why the prophets say so much about the Messiah. God will form His people, His real people, in the Messiah. So, as you're reading the prophets, like these kinds of details, keep pulling yourself back to those big picture things. God is judging. God rules the nations. God's looking for His people. God's going to form His people ultimately through the Messiah. The Messiah is coming. Those big, big themes, that helps us to process this. Okay, comments or observations, questions on Philistia? Okay, next section here. Chapter 5, 1 through chapter 16, verse 14. So it goes into, I think it appears to be halfway through chapter 16. And this is a judgment against Moab. Moab is right here. So when the Israelites came up from the wilderness wandering after 40 years, they came up through Moab, and it was on the plains of Moab where Moses addresses the next generation of Israelites. This is the book of Deuteronomy, and this is where Moses will perish. But the Moab is this section right in here. Now, anybody remember what happens with a particular king of Moab? His name was Balak, regarding the Israelites passing through his land. You might know what King Balak tried to do. Okay, excellent. All kinds of answers. I didn't understand any of it. But that shows that you know something happened. Ray, I think you said something. Did you say something? Okay. Balak tries to curse the Israelites through what method? Hiring a prophet by the name of Balaam. Prophet for hire, Balaam. He's a hatchet. He's trying to pay him to curse the Israelites like a spiritual hatchet man. And of course, every time Balaam tries to curse the Israelites, he ends up what? Blessing them. So, it's a sort of a crazy kind of thing that happens there in the book of Numbers. And of course, it's got a talking donkey and everything else. So, there you go. So the Moabites fear the Israelites and even try to oppose them. But that's not the end of Moabite in Old Testament history. Who's possibly the most well-known, biblically known female from Moab? Ruth. So Naomi's family migrated to Moab during one of the famines during the judges' years, and Ruth becomes part of the family, migrates back to Israel, and there you go. Ruth ends up being an ancestor to David. So, I think this is also very interesting. Moab still stays there. They're hovering there. And we learn that one of the wives of Solomon, 1 Kings chapter 11, was a princess of Moab. And of course, what did Solomon's foreign wives do to his heart? Turned it away from Jehovah to other gods. To the point that Solomon actually built a high place to a Moabite god by the name of Chemosh, just on the hill east of Jerusalem, sort of around that Mount of Olives area. We call it Mount of Olives in the New Testament. So do you see what role Moab has there? A destructive foreign influence on God's people. So let's look what happens to them. Let's read verses 1 to 5. Daryl, can you read that? Chapter 15, 1 to 5. We'll do it.
oracle concerning Moab. Surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated and ruined. Surely in a night, Ker of Moab is devastated and ruined. They have gone up to the temple and to Dibon, even to the high places to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. In their streets they have girded themselves with sackcloth. On their housetops and in their squares, everyone is wailing, dissolved in tears. Heshbon and Elilah also cry out. Their voice is heard all the way to Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles within him. My heart cries out for Moab. His fugitives are as far as Zoar and Eglath Shelishiah. For they go up to the ascent of Luhith weeping. Surely on the road to Horonaim they raise a cry of distress over their ruin.
All right, thank you. Good job with the names. Let's work backward in this text here a little bit. What are things, statements like baldness of head and beard shorn and sackcloth, what do those indicate, you think? Mourning and hardship. And what are they doing in verse 4 and verse 5 that indicates hardship, mourning?
Crying out.
Crying, they're weeping. It just keeps saying it over and over and over in these different places. Why? Go backwards. Look in verse 1. What's happened to Moab? Destruction. They've been laid waste. And so this is another scene of an invading force that's just wiped them out. And it's also possible the baldness of head and the beard shorn might be indicative of taking captives, because that was a common thing they would do, is shave everybody. Don't want their cooties on us. I mean, literally, that's true. They thought, you know, they may have some kind of disease or insect or something on them. And so they just clean them up. I mean, in every way, I mean, we saw this earlier in Isaiah, how that God describes Assyria as coming through Israel and shaving it like a razor, shaving it clean. In every way, even physically, when these ancient invading armies came through, they just shaved it clean. In so many ways. Which is, our modern warfare is so different, especially American warfare. When America feels like it's going to go in and do something and they blow up a bunch of stuff, then they go in, they give out soccer balls and they build hospitals and they, you know, build schools. And that's not what ancient armies did. Ancient armies didn't do those kinds of things. They wiped you out and then they went home. Took what was valuable. So that's why when Persia comes along, watch how Persia is a little different. Persia's different. They're quite sophisticated. Moderns want to act like that they're very sensitive to human rights. And it's not so much that they were sensitive to human rights. They just ruled more shrewdly, with more goodwill, rather than just knocking you in the head and stomping you and taking everything you've got. Persia was a lot more sophisticated and delicate how they did things. They could be devastating. So here Moab is wiped out. And if you look down in verse 6 and 7, they also appear to be experiencing what in verse 6 and 7? What?
Famine.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is symbolic language. I don't think so. It's the idea of drought, and drought produces famine, as Becca said, and so there is this lack of water. And so it's not strange, right? We've seen this like in the prophecy of Joel with the locusts. Sometimes God's judgment would be characterized not just by invading armies, but also by natural disasters. So this could have happened. And then look down, the oracle extends into chapter 16, the oracle against Moab. Verse 11, let's make this point before we get there. What does Isaiah say in verse 5 about Moab? It sort of strikes you funny. What does Isaiah write in verse 5? My heart cries for him. Understand that in reading these prophets, sometimes they are speaking directly for God. They're quoting God. Sometimes they're speaking from their own perspective as they're inspired by God. Sometimes it's just third party. just neutral, subjective observation. Yeah, Jennifer?
It could be too, because the Moabites, Ammonites, and Israelites had a common ancestor.
They did.
Abraham.
Excellent.
And Moab and Ammon were from Lot.
Back to Lot. Excellent. That's a great observation, because sometimes you do see that these nations are at odds with Israel at times, but also you see statements that there is this kinship, okay? But Isaiah is crying for them. Now, what do you make of that? Well, these prophets, as fierce as their words could be about judgment, they had hearts. And when God judges, it's a sad thing. It really is. And then look at verse 11. Verse 11, Karen Youngblood, can you read chapter 16? I'm sorry, verse 11, that one verse. 16:11, please.
Therefore my inner parts moan like a lyre for Moab, and my inmost self for Peresh.
Isn't that special, you musicians in the room? He's expressing this moaning and mourning again for them. My inner parts moan like a lyre. You know, we know that instruments of music are used to communicate joy, but they're also used to communicate mourning and sadness and forlorn and depression even. You know, and just, I'm with Rick. I mean, I like them sad. I like them sad. That I feel good when the song's sad, okay? And he's talking here about his inner parts moan like a lyre. It's like his heart, sort of like Ephesians 5:19, you make melody in your heart to the Lord. His heart is playing a sad song for Moab. It's like he's playing a lyre. It's, wow, appreciate the poetry of Isaiah and the figures and the images. They're incredible. Yeah, got that. Look at verse 6. For what is Moab being judged?
Their pride.
Their pride. Now we know that these ancient nations, in every case, in the prophets, they're judged because they don't know God, and they're judged because they're rebellious against God. They're judged because they have foreign gods and all the pagan gods and all that, whether Judah, Israel, Moab, Edom, whoever. But this is a pattern. We've already seen it with references about Assyria and Babylon. One of the reasons why God judges nations is because of their pride, their arrogance. We're number one. We're the best. Nobody's done it like we've done it. Aren't we the greatest thing? Aren't we the greatest nation on earth? Babylon said that. Syria said that. Moab even crowed. And God judged him for it. That's a real sobering point. And then verse 5. What do you make of verse 5 that he's talking about Moab, but there's going to be this throne and somebody's going to sit on it. And in verse 5, who's going to sit on it in faithfulness? Somebody from whom? Ten of David. We have no historical basis for concluding that any Davidic king after this point forward ruled over Moab. Matter of fact, the Davidic kings are, they're going to be on, you know, limited basis. Short time. About another century of Davidic kings, and then they're done. When the Babylonians come. How would you understand this? In faithfulness, a ruler of David is going to sit on a throne and rule. Who would that be?
Christ.
Right. One who judges, seeks justice, is swift to do righteousness. It's quite amazing. Don't be shocked in all the places that the prophets will drop a messianic prophecy. Sometimes it's abrupt even. To us. But it's not unfitting, because nation after nation is going to be judged. Nation after nation is falling short of God. Is there any ruler? Is there any kingdom that will be pure and just and righteous and humble before God and obedient to God? Yes, the Messiah's kingdom. Even though it's going to be centuries later. Okay, thank you so much.